All right, welcome. All right, my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. And we'll start with a meditation. And we have some hearing assisted devices. So if you're having trouble hearing me, just go in the back table and we can give you one to use. A poem called Trow by Judy Sorum Brown. There is a trough in waves, a low spot, where the horizon disappears and only sky and water are our company. And there we lose our way, unless we rest, knowing the wave will bring us to its crest again. There we may drown if we let fear hold us within its grip and shake us side to side and leave us flailing, torn, disoriented. But if we rest there in the trough, our silent being with the low part of the wave, keeping our energy and noticing the shape of things, the flow, then time alone will bring us to another place where we can see horizon, see the land again, regain our sense of where we are and where we need to swim. Trow by Judith Sorum Brown. So tonight, we start this final month of exploration around the Paramis. And I thought we would basically use the month as a way to look at them as a whole. Because we've been going through month by month, focusing on each Parami, diving deeply around that, learning more details around it, you know, having a way to kind of flesh out that whole experience. But I think it's helpful also to step back and see how they work together, how they actually reinforce each other, and support each other. So the 10 paramis are a common list in Buddhism. The paramis translates as perfections, if you're new to this topic. Now, perfections is kind of a big word. We think, okay, I've got to somehow perfect these and do my to-do list and something I got to achieve as a practitioner, and where am I? Am I doing better than so-and-so or worse than? And we can get really tight about it. But think of it more as just these aspirations for developing and opening toward. Now, the Buddha is said to have cultivated these paramis, these different perfections, over all his lifetimes before he became the Buddha. So he would develop generosity and develop ethics and morality, develop wisdom. And at some point, you know, once he had them all kind of fully developed, then he was ripe for awakening. So it sounds a little bit like, you know, one of those punch cards you get, you know, once you get 10, you get a free awakening or something. So it's not to be disrespectful, but it's sometimes we can take that attitude. So I think it's better to not see it as something to achieve, but more, how can I flesh out, can I round out my practice? Because if I just have some of the paramis, and as you listen to, we're going to go through each of the paramis tonight, as you listen to them, and some of them you're going to resonate with, like, okay, I really like loving kindness, I really like maybe equanimity, but maybe ethics, I don't know if I like that so much. So notice what kind of the reaction you have to each of those. And the ones that perhaps you have some reaction to are actually a place you have the most growth potential. Actually grow into them, learn more about yourself, and round out your practice. Because one way to hold it is as a way of really filling out our spiritual practice in a more complete, comprehensive way. Now, this list of the 10 paramis, it's interesting, different traditions of Buddhism have different numbers of lists. Like we have 10, we have the most. And then others like Zen have like six. So it's kind of which ones were chosen. And also this doesn't come from the early teachings of the Buddha. You can't find a sutta that goes through the paramis that came later in the commentaries. So I think it's still very helpful, very important to work with. Now I'm going to go through them tonight sequentially, and then in 2 weeks we'll explore them in a different way. And sequentially in showing how each one leads to the next one. And that's a powerful way to explore it. But at the same time, they don't have to be, you don't have to like get all the other ones before you can get to some of the later ones. You can work on them all at once. You can work on ones kind of an out of order. And we could actually go and look at each one of them and see how each one supports and leads to the next one. So these paramis, again, if some of them are ignored, our practice is not so as rich and full as it could be. So let's dive into that. So generosity is the first parami. Now it's interesting that this is the first one that was chosen to be part of this list. Because you look at the Buddha's path to awakening, it was very much kind of an individual practice. He really practiced. He practiced with people, but it was his own personal awakening that happened. And yet we're starting with generosity. And it said that the Buddha would often start training people on this path with generosity practices. And you think about generosity, it shifts us from this egocentric, self-centered, isolated perspective to one of interconnection and interrelationship. Because you actually have to perceive another person. You have to perceive that they perhaps have some lack, there's something that they need that you can share. It also helps to shift us from this sense of hoarding, like trying to hold on to our own resources, our own money, or even our own spiritual attainment, to actually let that be freely offered, freely shared. That's the Pali word for generosity is dana. And that's why we use this as teachers in this tradition, because there's a freely offeredness at the trainings, at the teachings. We don't charge a fee for the teachings, and yet we do really depend on people's generosity. So it's kind of a fundamental part of what makes this tradition, I think, unique and special in this day and age. So the sense of starting with generosity instead of something more self-focused, it's like starts with interrelationship. I think that tells us something important about the nature of awakening. That's not something that ultimately is a private thing that we keep to ourselves, but actually it's much more of a rejoining of interconnection, rejoining of union. You can imagine the Buddha, if he wasn't generous, if he was really kind of contracted around that, there'd be something really lacking in his awakening, lacking in his development as a spiritual being, a spiritual practitioner. And the same thing for ourselves. If we notice that we have trouble being generous, it's something for us to turn toward and explore and look at. And I always think it's helpful to be conscious of how we turn toward something that seems to be lacking in us. Because if we're not conscious of it, we're going to tend to lead with our normal judgment. There's something wrong with me. Something needs to be improved and fixed and changed. And I'm already in opposition with what I'm trying to fix, the lack of generosity in this case. But if instead I turn toward it with curiosity, with a quality of openness, a receptivity, to let me see what this is like. What's it like in this internal physical experience, this mental, emotional experience when I feel that contraction of heart? Just like in the meditation practice, we learn to open to experience now with an agenda without trying to change things, but actually to notice it just how they are. Right? There's plenty of time for us to change things, but meeting this moment just how it is starts to transform something very deep in ourselves, allows us to see in a more full, complete way. So if you find any of these paramis, okay, I just don't feel like I'm very well developed in that, use it as a chance to explore, to notice. What's it like when the mind is contracted, is ungenerous? Now, from generosity, we're connecting and noticing others. We notice, okay, this person needs something that I have. And instead of holding it tight, I'm willing to open my hands, open my heart, and share it. And in this way, our hearts start to open. And in that opening and connecting with others, we start to care about their well-being. And this flows very naturally and easily into the next parami of ethics, or sometimes called morality. And this is the basic understanding of what causes harm, and having this commitment not to cause harm to others. Because when we connect through generosity, we become more and more aware of the positive effect of our actions. And we also start to see the negative effect of our actions. When we steal something from someone, when we tell a lie, when we misuse our sexual energy, when we harm and kill, there's this impact that starts to become less and less tolerable, because our practice starts to make us more and more attuned and connected and sensitive to ourselves and to others. This is a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful thing. And it also starts to help, makes it harder to be unethical. It's said that someone who's fully awakened, they can't cause harm anymore. Now, the five precepts are a core aspect of this. So there's non-killing, the refraining from taking life, refraining from stealing, refraining from harm through our sexuality, misconduct, and harm from that, refraining from lying, and refraining from substances which cause heedlessness and intoxication. So these precepts, we'll actually be taking them as a community in January. I think it's January 6th, is that right? Yep, January 6th. So we have all three guiding teachers up here, Tuari Salah, Carrie Peterson, and myself. I mean, we're hoping that Carrie can be a guiding teacher. We have a board meeting on Wednesday, but I think it's going to happen. But at any rate, the three fully authorized teachers will be out up here leading this evening. It's a wonderful evening because we chant the precepts, we talk about the precepts and the importance of those and the refuges, and we all come together with that commitment. And in these days, too, there's more nuances around ethical actions. You know, if you're in a helping profession, if you're a therapist or a doctor or a teacher, there's more and more understanding of some of the subtle qualities of ethical trouble, boundary violations. That's part of this, because we become more and more aware of the harm that can be caused by power differential. When someone in more power can have more impact on someone with less power. And as we start to deepen our internal relationship to ethics, and this is, all these are meant to be not something that we just kind of chant once a year, but actually apply. And this is a very rich area to work with. You know, notice which ethics do I start to have trouble with? Which precepts do I kind of fudge around? It's like, okay, it's all right to tell a little bit of a white lie, or maybe steal that little thing from the company, or, you know, take that extra sample or whatever it might be in the grocery store. But as we start to practice with it, we start to become more and more quiet internally. And there's a natural falling away of behaviors which cause harm. And this starts to lead to renunciation. Renunciation, the third parami. And because of generosity and ethics, we start to understand more clearly what causes suffering and what causes happiness in our lives, in the lives of others. You know, we start to see it actually real time. We start to know that sensitivity starts to, we feel the echoes of something I said which was unkind or untrue. I can feel the echoes of turning away from an opportunity to be generous. I feel that contraction of heart. I start to perceive other people's experience of that harm. And then the more we see it, we start to become more, there's more energy and the more commitment to not do that. And this is where renunciation starts to come in. There's also the growing sense of what causes happiness, what causes that sense of freedom, that opening of the heart. And there's a renunciation of things which don't lead to that. So renunciation, we can think of it as releasing what leads to suffering, releasing what causes harm in ourselves and others. Sometimes it's defined as renouncing sensual pleasure. And I think that's actually not quite right, because sensual pleasure is just part of being human. You can have an intense sense of pleasure of maybe for whatever spectrum is this as we might have. But the problem is when we start to cling to it, we start to contract around it, which leads to suffering. So clinging is one of those Buddhist terms that has a very technical definition, but it's basically we start to become attached to something. We want it to stay the way it is. We don't want it to end. We want to get rid of what's unpleasant, get what's pleasant, and we start to direct our lives that way. Some of that is natural. Some of that is healthy. We want all to have comfortable lives. But when there's that clinging, that's the trouble that happens. So renunciation is that releasing of that. Now sometimes renunciation happens through a clear perception of what causes harm. I sometimes use this analogy, if this timer here was a rock that was really red hot, but in the fire, and I pick it up and it burns my hand, I'm going to drop it right away. If I really feel the burn and I really connect that, it's unlikely I'm going to pick that up again. Right? So that's part of that clear seeing, is that we start to see those moments, we perceive those moments of harm. You know, and that's one of the, it's kind of a tough part of practice, but it's also a very rich part of practice, is we're willing to have difficult conversations with people. You know, telling, like I've shared this example in my own life with my family, if sometimes I act in a way that's a little controlling or a little bit tight, judgmental. And I sometimes ask my wife and my daughter, tell me about what the impact is on my actions to you. And if I was able to really listen and take that in, that has a very strong effect of feeling that burn, pain, feeling the harm that I was causing to them. And so renunciation becomes much more effortless. It's not something that I'm trying to do. So you start to find that in your own life, that you start to let things just fall away, that you act in a different way. We're kind of in the holiday season. Perhaps you notice this over the Thanksgiving weekend. You're with, you know, maybe your family, that sometimes there's charged relationships. Maybe you find yourself acting in a different way, not picking up the invitation to go into old patterns. Maybe there's some little bit more openness, some more connection that would just naturally, spontaneously arise. I think it's really important to celebrate and notice those times. And that's one of the things in our Sangha meetings or community meetings like this. We have a chance to share that. Because a lot of times it'd be hard to kind of explain, you know, what happened. But you talk about with fellow meditators, they get you. They get understand this whole process. So that's one of the, when we do these dialogue, you know, discussion meetings every other week, there's a very helpful times to dive in around those. So sometimes it comes from just seeing very clearly. Sometimes it comes from a different way, that we bring an intention around it, an energy to look at it, to explore it, to pay attention, to see the pattern more clearly. So I'm still kind of lost in the pattern. I still act from the pattern. By this, I recognize it. I start to see it more clearly. I start to bring intentionality not to keep following through on that. What this does is starts to cool down the pattern. Because if it's kind of where you keep throwing gasoline on the fire, it's too hot to see. It's too hot to have clarity around it. We start to notice it. It's already started to cool down, which allows us to perceive it more clearly. So these first three paramis of generosity, of ethics, and of renunciation also have this effect of just kind of cooling down this whole system. What I mean by cooling it down is that we often come to practice really driven by our fears, our hatreds, our desires. It's like there's a lot of internal fire, a lot of internal lack that we're trying to fill, we're trying to overcome. Classically, we would call this the three delusions or kleshas of greed, of hatred, and delusion. And these forces tend to shape, really drive a lot of our suffering. There's an unconsciousness around how that greed shows up, how that hatred shows up. So these first three start to counteract the expression of that. By being generous, we become less greedy. By becoming more ethical, we're becoming less driven by hatred. By renunciation, we're starting to cultivate wisdom. And what arises in its place is wisdom. And this is the next parami. I often think of wisdom not as so much as knowledge that I'm obtaining and kind of stacking up so I can tell you all the links of the 10 links of dependent origination or the Eightfold Path or the 10 paramis, but it's more of this direct knowing, this direct seeing of things, this understanding the nature of how things actually are. In some ways, it's outside of our thoughts, our ideas, because it's a direct experience. We use our ideas to kind of, and our thinking mind to kind of make sense of it, to articulate it, but it's the direct seeing which matters. And it's in part of this wisdom too, it's something that we can't really possess or own, or saying, this is mine. It's like when the clouds shift. You guys, you can shift over, you can shift a whole nother seat over. Doing a little rearranging in the room here. Talking about clear seeing. Feel free to make yourself at home. So the sense of like a cloud, you know, cloudy sky, like today in Seattle, it was so cloudy the whole day. But if the clouds cleared, you could see the stars above. But we don't say, okay, the stars are mine. We don't see the sky as mine. It's like we're seeing something in a much broader way. And that's also a hallmark of wisdom. It is not something that's mine, uniquely mine. It's something that it's shared. We've cleared our dust from our eyes to see clearly. So it's really the fading away of what obscures that allows wisdom. And so the way the first three paramis work, it's like if we had a glass of muddy water, we had like a, you know, from the Mississippi or something, and we kept shaking it up, that mud is going to stay suspended. All the sediments are going to stay suspended in it. We just set the glass down and be still with it. It starts to quiet, starts to settle. So there's a clarity of that water. And I think it's similar with the precepts and with generosity. Because if I'm always kind of turning away from generosity and keeping my heart closed, if I'm always... think of Scrooge, you know, he has that sense of contraction of heart. That's keeping that glass stirred up. If I'm constantly lying and stealing, causing difficulty for others, that's keeping the glass stirred up. Start to practice it. Start to practice renunciation. There's that clarity that starts to arise. And there's three areas of wisdom that we often can kind of highlight. And these are the three characteristics of dukkha, of anicca, and anatta. And we talked about this in the threes, I guess, last year. So anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca is impermanence, that everything arises and passes away, everything that's conditioned. We often live in ignorance of that or denying that fact. When we start to live in harmony with that, that's a growth of wisdom. We start to understand dukkha, or it's often translated as suffering. We see what causes suffering. We start to see that in a more clear way. We're not confused by that. That leaves clarity to us. And then anatta, non-self. One of the more subtle aspects of this practice, and yet one of the more central aspects, is that this sense of me who's living years, having these experiences, doing this job and work and relationships, is kind of an isolated, contracted self. We start to realize that that is actually just a container that we put around perception itself, a container we put around awareness itself, and that actually can be released. So what comes in its place is a deep sense of interconnection, and perception that's not centralized in that sense of self. Not in a way that is dysfunctional, but actually allows you to be much more spontaneous and engaged in life. So perceiving these three is a perception of wisdom. Now from wisdom, we move to the next parami, and that is of energy. So this clear seeing of wisdom brings the energies. Okay, I want to go more into that. My heart starts to, you just have this motivation to try to understand these in a deeper and deeper way. So there's twofold of it. One is seeing those burning rocks more clearly, perceiving, oh, this is causing suffering. This contraction of mind, this assumption of self, this denial of impermanence, this illusion of not seeing through, seeing dukkha clearly, all these cause suffering. So you start to feel those rocks more and more clearly. And that brings energy to not pick up those rocks, to find where those other rocks are, to avoid those and discover others. So that's the releasing of suffering. The other side of energy is moving toward freedom, is moving toward joy and happiness. That's not based on the conditions or situations of life, but it's actually coming from the very way that we are being in the world. The shift of this orientation of who and what we are starts to shift. Because usually our happiness kind of depends upon the situations in our life, right? Someone says you did a great job, we feel happy. Someone says you did a really bad job, we feel unhappy. You know, how do we find balance, that's happiness which is outside of that? So we start to align with these three characteristics. We start to have an open heart. We start to soften that grip of the contracted mind. So all this takes energy, because we do have this kind of force of delusion and unconsciousness and ignorance, which is tending to keep us tied to suffering. And so the energy comes forth to meet that. Energy often goes into our practice, right? Our meditative practices, practicing in a regular way, daily way, going on retreats, working with contemplation, reading the suttas, reading other Dharma books. All these are ways of expressing energy. Coming in, or energy is what allows that to happen. Showing up and talking about your life, talking about your practice. Or chanting practice, however the form it is. And there's also the informal ways of integrating our understanding into our life. These are how we are in our relationships, how we are with our jobs, how we act in the world. Because we more and more want to have our lives be an expression of our practice. I think that's one of the fundamental things of Seattle Insight, is that's, it's, for me, that's one of our big purposes, is to help us learn how to integrate our lives into our practice, to actually show up and live as wisely as we can, to live with much as compassion as we can. And this is an expression of energy. Now, energy then is followed by patience. This is interesting. Okay, bring this energy. Now, okay, patience though. Kind of like push-pull me, right? Which way do you want to go? Because that energy sometimes brings a sense of urgency, a sense of impatience, really. You know, I want to be fully awakened now. I want to be done with this pattern. I don't want to have this pattern ever again. And so we have a lot of energy to try to overcome it, but that energy in itself sometimes by itself gets in the way, because it can shift into aversion. It can shift into kind of my will. I'm trying to overcome myself, become a better version of myself. And so wisdom actually steps in and says, let's bring patience into this. So you start to see how energy by itself needs patience to counterbalance it. And this is part of what wisdom brings, is this willingness to let things unfold at their own pace, at their own time. Right? So there's the patience of just daily life, like you're driving and someone is driving much slower than you want to be driving. You know, can you let that unfold? Can you let someone who is moving slowly or a different pace than you, can you allow them to have their own movement through the world? Because things are going to unfold the way they are anyway, but we start to recognize and harmonize with it. So there's a cooling of this fire of energy, so it's going to start to counterbalance it. And so we're trying to find a balance really between the two. Because if it's too much one way or the other, too much patience, we don't have the energy to really go into some of the deeper aspects of our practice, to open to some of the deeper pains that we might have, to see some of the deeper roots of suffering. If you have too much energy, though, we get kind of fried from that. We get exhausted by it. To use a couple gasoline engine metaphors, like the carburetor, which balances gasoline and oxygen. You have to have the right mix for the car to run well. A clutch, you know, I don't know how many people drive clutches anymore, but a clutch, you have to be able to have that right balance of clutch and gas. Otherwise, the car will not run. And so it starts to be with these two, energy and patience, there's a growing harmony with how life has unfolded. And that's one of the hallmarks of our practice, if we start to feel more harmonious with life. We're not so brittle. We're not so particular about how things are. We're able to respond to different situations, sometimes very difficult situations, medical and health crises, things in the greater society, and yet we're able to stay present and stay connected. Our own mental world, we start to become more balanced with it. We stop demanding the life to meet our expectations and start to find more flow and ease with it. So from patience, the next parami is truthfulness. Now it's interesting to come back to truthfulness because in some ways it was covered in the morality or the ethical part, not speaking lies. I think the ethical part mostly focuses on this not lying. Now there's this it's kind of a cute sutta, but it's also a very powerful sutta where the Buddha is talking to his son. So remember, the Buddha left, he basically abandoned his family to go become a monk. But then after he became awakened, he brought his son back. His son actually wanted to come and become a monk. Buddha got in a little bit of trouble because he took his son a little young into that robes. So some rules came up around that. But that's an aside. But the Buddha is talking to his son. I think his son was like six or something and had told a fib or something. So the Buddha took a bowl that was using to wash feet and said, okay, see how much, you know, dumped it out, see how much water is left in here. That's how much is left of your spiritual growth if you've told a lie. And he, you know, said, okay, turn it upside down, see how empty that is, how overturned, same thing with your spiritual practice. So you can really put this this lesson that anything that, basically, if someone tells a deliberate lie, there's nothing they're not capable of doing. You know, that's a powerful statement. That anyone who's willing to tell a deliberate lie, consciously lie, all the other precepts, they're much more able to break. So this sutta, you know, it's a strong one, but it's also cute how he describes it in a way that the six-year-old could understand. But with this one, truthfulness, this parami of truthfulness, all these other aspects, other paramis of wisdom, of energy and patience start to work with it, to start to have a deeper understanding of it. We start to have a deeper relationship to the importance of being truthful. And this parami is perhaps more focused on this expression of what's true. You know, there's not lying, but then there's what is actually true in this moment. There's a growing owning of our own experience, of our actions, our opinions. And there's an honesty about, okay, this is just my idea, this is my opinion. It's not an absolute truth. I think there's also this element of being more truly yourself, and being more comfortable in your skin. Certainly in my own practice, so I was reflecting with someone about this, that, you know, through all these years of practice, I've become much more relaxed in myself. You know, when I started practicing, I was insecure. I was worried about what people thought. I was worried about being liked and disliked, I mean, still, that still operates. That's part of my personality, part of my conditioning. But instead of, in terms of driving it, instead of being, let's say, you know, 90, 80% of what's driving me, it's down to maybe 10% of what drives me. So it becomes this way of being more comfortable with who you are. And also more comfortable and accepting of other people, how they are. You know, meeting them, okay, this is a unique manifestation of this being. I think this is an expression of this truthfulness. There's a deeper integration and alignment. And this leads to the next one, resolve, the next parami of resolve. So we start to connect with what's true and express it. There's this deeper determination to express, to actually really go as deeply as I can in my practice. It can be this deep commitment, this unwavering determination to realize this Buddhist path, this dharmic path. It's interesting that this parami comes at this point in the list. So instead of coming at the beginning, which we often would think, you got to get resolution. You got to be determined to start this practice at the very beginning. But yet, if it was the beginning, I think for most of us, we would have a certain kind of ego-driven part to that determination. I want to get better. I want to attain something. And this is how we often do things in our life. You know, think about all the things you've accomplished in your life. There's probably a lot of determination that started that process. You know, going to school, getting skills, whatever it might be, there's a certain energy that comes. And for myself, often that was tied with my own self-worth, trying to make myself a better person. Again, there's some way there's nothing wrong with that, as long as we don't become attached with that sense of self, which changes. But at the beginning of our practice, there's not enough wisdom and clarity to really support this. At this stage in the paramis, it comes from a place of wisdom, of clear seeing. There's a balance of energy between energy and patience. We've seen our impact of our actions for both good and bad, through generosity, through ethics, through non-ethics, through non-generosity. We have this capacity through the balancing of energy of patience, and the balancing of those two to be able to have an actual determination. Because sometimes we start off with something, we have resolve before we really have the capacity to be resolved. You think about the first time you practiced, you thought, okay, this meditation stuff is so great. I want to just, my whole life is going to be meditation. Everything I'm going to do. And you have this deep, you know, desire to do it, but you don't have, you can't do it yet. You don't have the capacity, right? This is like the blind or the bright faith that Sharon Salzberg talked about in her book, Faith. Now, there's this enthusiasm, but it's not supported by experience. It's not supported by skill, by being able to navigate yourself in different ways. So as our practice deepens, we become more realistic. We become more tempered with our own experience. And ideally, we start to have a deeper conviction of how the practice works. We start to see these ways that we are just kind of shifting in our lives in a way that allows us to be more connected, more present. That starts to bring a lot of energy and determination. Let me let that deepen more. And in this way, it starts to have a positive feedback loop. We see the effects of our practice that encourage us to have more energy to practicing more, to deep more deeply, more fully, that again allows more seeing, which grows and grows. You start to see more clearly the suffering caused by acting from greed, hatred, and delusion, and you have a deeper resolve to avoid that. And then now the last two paramis. From that sense of resolve this, okay, this deep commitment to awaken, to deepen our practice. The next parami is loving kindness. Right? So this is a beautiful reminder that it kind of brings us back to the beginning of generosity. Because loving kindness, I often frame it as this turning toward, this willingness to be next to an experience, next to a person, next to someone, versus turning away. So it's reaffirming that quality of interconnection, of interrelationship. So you start to see how the paramis all work together, all function together. Now paramis, or this, I'm sorry, the loving kindness parami is interesting because it's not just about being loving and kind. Because for most of us, we can be loving and kind to the right people. Right? You know, it's easy to be kind to a young child, as long as they're not crying or whining or something, putting their sticky hands everywhere. You know, if they're just, you know, or a puppy, as long as it's not peeing on your floor. There's just this kindness that comes forth, right? But it's often conditional. Loving kindness is saying, okay, we actually have to transform this to something much deeper. Have you ever done a practice of formal metta meditation or loving kindness meditation? You go through different categories of beings. You'd start with maybe someone like yourself. You offer metta to a friend, to a neutral person, to a benefactor, to someone who's difficult, or sometimes who you have a lot of difficulty toward. And then you go into all beings. Now you start to do that, you realize metta has to come from a different place than my conditional love, my conditional affection. It asks us to find a deeper way of expressing that friendliness of heart that transcends or sees through the perceived differences. Another way to say it is it touches the essence of things. And it also goes into beyond the human realm. You sometimes do metta to all the creatures that swim in the water, all of that fly in the air, that wiggle on the earth. So you start to see how vast metta can be. So you start to connect with metta through all beings, which starts to lead to the final one of equanimity. So we just covered this last month, so I won't spend too much on it. But my favorite definition from Christina Feldman is this equally near all things. I think this is such a beautiful phrase because it helps safeguard against the tendency to see equanimity as a distancing, as a disconnection, as a sense of structuring or sheltering the heart, but being equally near. I like this, I don't like this, but there's an equal nearness to this. So it's a balance of mind, a balance of heart. It's really informed by wisdom. All right, so those are the 10 paramis. We went through them very quickly. But hopefully as you listen, you might have found, okay, some of those I want to know more about, I want to cultivate in my life. So making a note of that. And equally noticing the ones like, oh, I'll save that one for later. Maybe bringing energy to that one also. And so these qualities, there's really a comprehensive list of this humanness. And they all counterbalance and work and support each other. We could have gone through any one of them and seen how this one leads to the next one. We could have re-scrambled it and did the same kind of process. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a moment or two, let those words settle. So this title of this talk, I'm saying something like paramis interconnected. So seeing how they all interrelate. So this week, reflect on each of the 10 paramis as a whole. So we've been going through each one at focal. Try to hold it as a big picture. How does this whole list work? And how do they work together in your life? You know, how does it function in your relationships, in your jobs, in your tasks you do? And which one seems less developed in your practice? Which ones is like, okay, I just don't quite get that one, or I don't really have much energy for it. And what's the effect of that imbalance? Remember what I said early on in the talk, try to see that without judging yourself. See it with curiosity. See it to understand. And from there, that's the optimum to learn and grow. All right, so we have a chance for any questions you might have. So in the room, if you could raise your hand and we could bring a mic around. And then if you're online, you can just raise your virtual hand. And I'll try to meet your question. I know the paramis, 10 is a lot. I think there's something about the human mind can only hold about seven things. You know, 5 is better, 3 is really good. So like 10, like when I first learned the paramis, like, oh, I can't keep track of them all. But you practice with it. You know, it's not about holding as a list that you've memorized, but just how do I practice in my life? All right, so go ahead, Kathy.
Thank you, Tim. I had this question just pop up, thinking about this, to be equally near all things. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about how that might work with preferences. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I prefer this view, or I prefer this food, or I don't. And I know that preferences is a whole other kind of subject of study, but to be equally near to all things, maybe just a little more explaining of that.
Sure. Yeah, I think one of the things we kind of get hung up on in practice is we tend to be a little absolute in it. Okay, equally near all things, that means I can't have preferences. It seems like it's an either or. Think of it just as there's different aspects of ourselves that we can bring forth. So I might have a preference, like, you know, I really don't prefer stubbing my toe and feeling the pain of that, right? So that's a preference, and I may take actions to avoid that. But yet once it happens, can I have a sense of, okay, this is how this moment is? Can I be open to this experience? They can also start to look at where the suffering is. First noble truth, dukkha. You can start to see how you relate to the moment. Does that cause more dukkha or less dukkha? So let's go back to the preference of not stubbing my toe. Oh, I stubbed it. I'm feeling all the pain of it, but I can have a sense of equanimity, or be equanimous with opening to that experience. Okay, I'm feeling the pain, but I'm not really trying to push it away. I'm not trying to avoid it. Now, if I start to say, okay, well, why did I stub my toe again? I'm such an idiot. Who left this here? Why can't they be more considerate? I'm adding more suffering to that whole process. Second dart teaching is another way of talking about it. But if there's a sense, oh, wow, this is not the moment I would have hoped for, and yet this is the moment it is. So there's a sense of balance. Even with meditation, it took me a while to kind of realize that the way I tend to practice with things which are difficult is I don't like latch onto it in a single-minded focus, but actually keep a sense of balance. So let's say the cup is what's painful, and let's say the clock is something which is not painful, is maybe even pleasant. I try to hold both equally. There's a sense of balance of awareness with both of those. And so, okay, just noticing, am I equally close to each thing? Am I equally available is another way of seeing it. Is my heart equally open to both sides of things? Doesn't mean we don't have preferences. And so it's kind of like we see that don't have to be absolute in this. Like, okay, I can be equanimous, and at the same time I can see this needs to change. I need to step in or try to make some change in myself, in my world, in my relationships. But there's still an equanimity that comes with that. So it's kind of a paradox, but a lot of the Dharma teachings, if you kind of relax the paradox, it starts to make a lot more sense. Did I help at all? Did I get it out to your question?
Yeah, that was great. So to be equally near all things, the pleasant and the unpleasant.
Yes. Yeah, and you can look at all 8 of the vicissitudes or the worldly winds. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. When you feel those, can you feel a sense of balance with that? It's like, oh, yeah, this is like a worldly wind that's moving through me. Instead of, I want to try to avoid pain, I want to avoid loss, I want to avoid criticism. You know, life is just not, that's not going to, you can have more suffering. So noticing, where is the dukkha? Where is the suffering with that? And I think that's a good rule of thumb is, as we practice, if we get confused, okay, what's leading to more suffering? And just try to withdraw the energy from that. what's leading to more freedom, and then put more energy into that. That's the Buddha's famously said, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. I know that's two things, but dukkha and the end of dukkha. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for your question. All right, what else? Anyone here in the room? Everybody got the paramis down here. Yes, Leslie. And then we'll go to Ellen, or Aileen next.
I am a little bit lost when you get to renunciation.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different than ethics? Is it just deeper or some more subtle investigation? I'm not sure.
Yeah, so the difference between ethics and renunciation. So ethics is like, it's really looking at our behavior, kind of our external behavior, okay? I'm going to steal something, I'm going to lie something, you know, harm someone, kill something. That's all, you kind of, there's a clarity with that. Renunciation is almost, it's really a support of ethics, but it's almost like it comes in before we actually act. Okay, I'm choosing to renounce that. And not only choosing not to act in a way that's harmful, but I'm also really working with renouncing some of the deeper, you know, perspectives that leads to that.
Sort of the thoughts before the actions kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, and that will, there's lots of ways you can do it. You can say, okay, I'm going to choose something I'm going to renounce because this is a pattern. We have to be careful of getting into the whole, especially with the New Year's resolutions and that kind of stuff, you know.
Trying to catch yourself before.
Like here's an example from my own practice. This is before I became a teacher. I was sitting in a sangha like this, you know, at Seattle Insight, in a different incarnation of our over at St. Mark's. But I was sitting, and there's a woman who sat next to me. I noticed, okay, there's a sense of attraction to this person, and so right there, okay, there's the ethics of that, of how I act. But then there's the deeper inclination to want to engage in that. But I could sense that, okay, that's going to cause more suffering. And I could just stop it there. Don't do it. You know, but that wasn't very helpful because that just is like, I'm just trying to, you know, keep this wild thing from expressing. But I started to say, okay, let me not act from it. Let me not engage with that desire to look at the person or whatever it might be, to actually turn toward what's driving that. What's the pull of that? And as I did that, it was interesting to feel this sense of lack, this sense of loneliness, of there's this kind of this deeper sense of insufficiency that I was able to touch more into. To the point I realized that this deep insufficiency doesn't matter. Anything external is not going to touch that. And so that's kind of a process of renunciation. I'm kind of combining investigation, mindfulness, renunciation, wisdom, all that part of it, understanding dukkha, but it's really the act of renunciation. That's a much deeper way. So it can be really a deep practice. I think that's a better way to do it instead of like white knuckling it. Okay, I'm, you know, like Lent or something. I mean, I've never practiced Lent, so I'm sure there's ways to practicing and it's very, very deep. You know, and Ramadan? Yeah, that, you know, there's a sense of releasing things that we can do it kind of as an external form, or we can do it as an internal form. And that's a nice way of looking at it. The internal form is going to go much deeper, and it is more subtle, it's harder to see. But it's like, so here's ethics, and here's the renunciation that's underneath to support it. That makes sense?
Yeah.
All right, so Aileen, go ahead.
Good evening, Tim. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
My question is kind of about the Brahma Viharas, but I don't know if it also relates to the other parami. I was talking to someone I know about feeling compassion for certain people that I had seen, and she said, well, you know, compassion is just another mind state. You just let it come and go like everything else. Like, just let your compassion come and go like other mind states. And I was very startled because I thought, with wise effort and energy, we're trying to cultivate these mind states and maybe prolong them a little bit and let these things like loving kindness and compassion and maybe even generosity, any of these mind states, you know, kind of prolong them. So can you comment on that and maybe help me get clearer about this?
Sure. And before I do that, just to kind of also kind of call forth our own kind of inner teacher, our own knowing. So as you had this relationship to compassion, which sounded like it resonated, right? It made sense to you. Mm-hmm. And then you had someone, you know, whether it's your friend or it could be a teacher or something you read that says, no, you're doing it wrong or whatever it might be. It's like, it's interesting. It's like the fifth hindrance of doubt is like we're kind of thrown into confusion a little bit. And that's one of those pieces as we practice, we start to rely more and more of our own understanding, our own sense of it. That sometimes, you know, we say things or said in ways which is a little confusing or is confused. And so just to trust your own, you know, noticing for yourself, okay, when I relate to compassion, it's something that I'm cultivating, that I'm really, you know, offering compassion to someone that I really want to practice with it, that really resonates. Right? And then seeing it as just a mind state that comes and go, there's a truth to that. But yet there's also this cultivation that I think for many of us, if not all of us, is really helpful to cultivate. So I'm going to really work with this compassion. Because it's easy to kind of get the practice. I don't know the intention with the other person and what, you know, they said and all that. But the way you're presenting it, it's like sometimes it can be a little bit of that the distortion around equanimity, for example, that, okay, everything is just coming and going or impermanence, things are coming and going, see everything as empty. They're empty, but they're also not empty. You know, to borrow a phrase from our Zen practitioners, from the Lotus Sutta, that when there's everything is empty and everything is full, emptiness is form and form is emptiness. So it's this back and forth. Same thing with compassion. And sometimes it's compassion, and that's really what I'm going to lead with and practice with it. And we could certainly point to compassion practices, like another Brahma Vihara that you can really cultivate. There's a sense of compassion, learning to open our hearts to pain and still find that place of stability, open to our own pain. And I don't think there's any downside to that. Yeah.
It certainly feels better to practice, to prolong these kinds of mind states than, you know, starting to worry about things and get annoyed with people.
Yes.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that points to like wise effort, which is, you know, noticing, you know, states which are kind of wholesome, which are beneficial, to how do you deepen those? How do you prolong those? How to allow those to deepen in a way? And states which cause suffering, which lead to unwholesome states, how do you release those? So you're right there. Yeah, if you have to choose between being worried and anxious and upset versus compassion, it's like a no-brainer. Focus on the compassion. Yeah, so you're welcome. Thank you for asking that. And it's also just a good reminder for all of us. You know, we learn to, you know, trust our own direct experience more and more. And sometimes we get confused, and a teacher may say, okay, you're a little confused about that. But that, you know, what you said there, I think I'll continue to practice the way you are. Thank you for sharing that. All right, what else is out there? Yes, go ahead.
Did you say you can have too much patience? Did you say that? Is that possible?
So Beth's asking, can you have too much patience? I was saying it as each of these paramis, you know, have kind of shadow sides or sides that we can kind of misinterpret. So patience, kind of, it's sometimes we talk about a near enemy, so something that is kind of like patience, but not quite. And so it's a way of kind of misinterpreting or getting out of balance. Mm-hmm. So if I had so much patience, I'm like, you know, I'm just like, oh, yeah, maybe the car hit the dog, maybe it won't. You know, I'm just going to see what happens. You know, there's an energy that has to come forth.
So that's a low energy. That's a, or maybe a withholding energy.
Yeah, there's that. Yeah, there's certainly that way. Another, maybe a more subtle but more common way is in our practice, we start to really feel the sense of calmness, a sense of tranquility. Mm-hmm. I can just kind of come into the breath and feel this, the sense of ease and stillness. And that can feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm being really patient with the experience. Yeah, but we may not realize, though, that we need some energy to start to see some of the deeper roots of our suffering. You know, and often this is going to show up because we kind of go to our happy place of meditation. It's like, okay, I got to take a break. Thanksgiving is getting too crazy. I'm going to go meditate. All right, so there's a beneficialness to that of finding grounding, resourcing, but there's also a turning away from something that's difficult. And so energy, if we have too much going into with the patience and the ease that comes from that, without this willingness to kind of get into the unconscious roots of our suffering, our practice isn't going to deepen the way it could. And we're not going to have the deeper releasing that and potential that it could have. You know, that sometimes we need that patience. We're like, we're always trying to dig and fix and worry. And sometimes it's like, you know, practice a little bit more patience. Does that make sense, Beth?
Yes, I was just looking and noticing that those two are together right smack in the middle.
Yeah.
And I feel like I missed that month. Maybe I need to go repeat. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's a good juxtaposition. Jack Kornfield, when I was doing my teacher training with him, he said that he asked Ajahn Chah, one of the you know, famous Thai forest meditation masters. He was listening to him answer questions. And one question he would say, you know, go this way. And the next question he would do the opposite. And so Jack kind of called him on that in a very, I'm sure, very respectful, polite way. But Ajahn Chah said, like, if we're walking down a road and there's a ditch on the left and a ditch on the right, if you're about to fall in the ditch on the left, I'm going to say go to the right. If you're about to fall in the ditch on the right, I'm going to say go to the left. But the point is to come to the center. So it's a little bit like that with patience and energy. That I might tell one question, one student, I might say, you need more energy. Another student, you need more patience. Yeah. All right, what else is out there? Any other questions or sharing? We have a few more minutes.
Hi. I think you touched a bit about like the reasons we come to meditation for a sec, maybe like within wisdom. And you were talking about hatred, delusion, something else, I forget. But I was wondering if you could kind of touch a little bit more on that and how we can kind of avoid those things.
Yeah, greed is the third one. So is your question more about what brings us to practice or how do we touch into those three?
The latter.
Yeah. Okay, how do we touch into those three? So those are called the three and wholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think of them as delusion is kind of the core one. And that's when delusion is like the not seeing, not perceiving clearly how things actually are. We're confused about what actually causes suffering, what causes happiness. And from there, it's much easier to act in a way that's causing from greed and from hatred. So a lot of it is just becoming more clear about that. And what I love about this practice is that we could approach it kind of from the outside in and saying that, okay, I want to be less greedy. I want to be less hateful. Okay, so anything on time I'm being hateful, I like stop myself from being hateful. Okay, greed, okay, I'm not going to want that anymore. I'm going to stop myself from being greedy. That's going to work for a while, but it's like the dam's going to break, you know. And it's like like periodically I try to stop eating sugar and that works for a while. And then I just start eating it again. But if you start to look at the deeper roots of that, so what I love about this practice is you just take the pattern just like it is. Almost you relax the intention to get rid of the pattern. Instead relate to it as something I want to understand very deeply. I start to notice, what's it like to want, let's say there's a cookie that I really want. So there's a sense of almost, you can sit in front of you and notice that you leaning into it, that the, how the body, the hand is almost reaching without you asking it to reach. The mouth starts to salivate. And you can actually start to notice, okay, what am I trying to feed here? Is it a sense of a reward? Is there a sense of feeling I'm sad, I want to kind of give myself a little, you know, boost up? Or am I a sense of, maybe there's a sense of chemicalness, a chemical imbalance I'm somehow trying to balance? Or my blood sugar is dropping? Or there's, you know, like Janine Roth, I think, has a book called Feeding the Hungry Heart. You start to feel that sense of what hunger am I trying to feel? Jan Chosen Bays wrote a book on mindful eating, and she goes through the 7 types of hunger. So that's all ways of kind of engaging with some pattern without trying to get rid of it or judge it, but to understand it very deeply. When we understand something very deeply, then it tends to let go of us. And so same thing with greed, same thing with hatred. You might find aversion. You're feeling a lot of hatred towards someone or something. You start to work with that. What does it feel like to feel anger and hatred? What's it feel like in the body? What's it feel like in the mind? What? How do my thoughts all kind of funnel toward that same energy of hatred? And by doing that, you're actually starting to loosen up delusion. You're starting to see more clearly. Does that help?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. Do you still have your question?
Yeah.
Can you grab the mic so they can hear you online?
I think you sort of you answered it in the previous answer, but just to state it, so you talked about anxiety.
Yes.
And to bring compassion towards it.
Mm.
Can you expand what that might mean?
Well, that question was around someone who had some advice about, you know, whether you should cultivate compassion or, you know, should you just see it as a coming and going of a mind state? And that person was saying that it was much better to focus on compassion versus just letting the mind, I'm kind of putting words into her mouth, but kind of letting the mind just kind of run, right? Because so I can really feel worried about someone, and I can worry about what's going to happen and the impact of that in their life. And all that is kind of adding more anxiety, right? But if I start to say, if I just go to kind of the kind of cut to the chase that, oh, I care that this person is suffering. You know, may their suffering decrease. May their suffering lessen. You know, so I'm actually expressing compassion toward them. So is there kind of compassion has these two parts, this turning toward experience of pain in ourselves and another person. Second part is, it's asking what's needed in this moment. What is can be done? Maybe it's simply being present with this person. Maybe there's an act of offering some food or water or some kind of clear thing. But it's different than when our mind starts to spin. It's like, you know, you get caught in snow and you're trying to get the tires out and they're just spinning. That's what the mind tends to do. And you can see like the merry-go-round mind when you kind of have these different horses of anxiety, they're going around. It's like, oh, there's that horse. Oh, there's that horse again. And it just keeps going around and around. Then I think that's a good time to have some kind of intervention on the mind. And compassion can be a gateway into it. So each one of us at different times, different gateways are going to be accessible. So sometimes saying, can I feel my... And here's another trick is when you're feeling a lot of struggle around anxiety or worrying about someone else, notice the suffering that you're feeling in yourself and bring compassion to that. Okay, you're touching that pain. I think a lot of that spinning of the mind is actually trying to avoid feeling the pain that's present. Compassion is about feeling that pain from a place of balance. Does that help? All right. Thank you, Ramali. All right. Anyone else? Maybe one more? Yes.
I'm worried that my deep understanding will be fraught with my own sneaky delusions.
Yeah, so that's a in some ways there's a wise worry to have, but it's again, how can we tell the difference between our delusion versus what's really true or wise? Here's one trick is that when we start to kind of solidify or codify around it, like, okay, this is the truth. There's a little bit of you know, and if someone disagrees with you, then you notice that, okay, I'm kind of, maybe my opinion is a little mixed in there. But if you have if we go out and it's raining and we have this direct experience of the rain and someone says, wow, the sunshine is really bright here. You're just like, you just let it go. You know, you don't have to argue the fact because you're able to connect with the reality of this. So that's how that sense of truthfulness or wisdom is really grounded in your direct knowing, your direct experience. But the part to notice is when you start to become attached to that. And there's the classic story of the elephant that is blind. I think classically it's blind men come up to try to touch it, and they each get a hold of a different part of the elephant, and they start to argue about what an elephant actually is. You know, so someone who has the tusk has a very different limited experience of the elephant than someone who has the tail or the ear or the trunk. So they're just yelling at each other. They're all grounded in their own experience, but it's a limited experience. So I think that's one of the safeguards, to realize that your own understanding, your own wisdom is always finite. It can always grow in deeper ways. And sometimes that's really a helpful thing. It's like, what do I think is true right now? And what if it isn't? Can I open to a different way? You know, and that starts to open to an alive quality of wisdom. I think wisdom is more of an aliveness that's almost meeting this moment how it is. You know, I can't like have a, you know, flashed cards of wise sayings and like, okay, wait, okay, that's the right one. You know, it's more of a spontaneous meeting of the moment. Yeah, that's an important question. All right, well, let's call that good. We're almost at the time. So, you know, practice with the paramis, you know, practice with them. So if the list feels like it's too much, that's, you can kind of read through that. You can reflect on that. You might read it before you practice and just start to notice how these interact. You might just pick two of them. We've talked about energy and patience, how those two come together. Now, how does equanimity and loving kindness balance each other? You know, how does wisdom flow? Just try to see. The point is to see how does this show up in your own understanding? How does this show up in your own experience? All right. So next week, I'll do a shorter recap of this talk for about 20 minutes, and then we'll have a chance for you to dialogue with each other around the paramis. And this is a really enriching live part of the practice. You get to actually hear someone talk about their practice and for you to share your own. And then week after that, then we'll go back into another talk around the paramis as a whole and then finish out the year. All right. Thank you all for your practice and your good hearts. And we'll see you next week. And thank you for everyone online for joining us. Be well.